comfortable for his last remaining days and hours. The Duke had sacked several nurses, but seemed to like Julie, as she hailed from his wife's hometown. For her part, she was not altogether sure how to talk to him. As a Women's Lib American, I was determined not to be intimidated by his title and position, she recalls, speaking for the first time about her experience. So she called him Duke, as in, "Hey Duke, how are you doing tonight?" As his favorite film that year was a John Wayne Western, The Cowboys, he seemed to like that. They chatted about her upcoming visit to India, the Duke recommending a book in his library on that subject, by the journalist and adventurer Lowell Thomas. There was one moment of excitement during her stay. The quiet of the evening was rudely shattered when the Duke's second-floor bedroom window was shoved open and a man peered in. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "I am a policeman. Someone has pushed the panic button." Julie ran down the hall to alert the sleeping Duchess.
"Don't worry, darling," she said. "I've pushed the button before when I'm bored."
Apart from his night nurse, the Duke had no other company in the evening apart from his pug dog, Black Diamond. During the 2 weeks Julie was with the ex-king, he was never once visited by his wife, whose quarters were on the same floor of their home but separated by what Wallace liked to call the boudoir. At the time, she had an American female guest and spent the evenings with her. Julie recalled, "She never came to see him, or kiss him goodnight, or see how he was, not once, poor fellow. He would call her name over and over, Wallace, 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 or darling, darling, darling. It was pitiful and pathetic, just so sad, like a lamb calling for its mother." On the night he died, Julie sensed that his life was drawing peacefully to a close. What the French call les corbeaux, black ravens, had chosen that evening to roost in the trees outside his bedroom window. These birds, traditionally seen as the harbingers of death, had come for him. They were not to be denied. His breathing became more agitated, Julie holding his hand to calm him. As he became increasingly restless, she cradled him in her arms, holding and soothing him. At 2:20 in the morning of Sunday, May 28, 1972, the once king and emperor died in the arms of a woman from Baltimore. "Right city, wrong woman," recalled Julie. So ended the royal romance of the century. The doctor, Jean Finn, was summoned and pronounced him dead, after which the Duchess was woken and she sat with him, holding his hand and whispering sweet nothings. No tears, no cries of anguish, just a gentle goodbye. Her own memory was, typically, rather different. She told her friend Aileen, Countess of Romanones, that shortly after 2 in the morning she was awakened by doctors and summoned to the Duke's bedside. As he breathed his last, she took him in her arms, his blue eyes gazing tenderly into hers. He uttered one word, "darling," and then he was gone. Her butler, Sidney Johnson, suggested that he actually said, "Mama, mama, mama, mama." Given that all are agreed that the Duke died in the early hours of the morning when night nurse Julie Chattard Alexander was on duty, her recollection, especially given the Duchess's waning faculties and her lifelong habit of altering the actualité, seems the most authentic. When the news was announced in the media, one of the first to send a note of condolence was her old adversary, Lucy Rogers. Since her visit to the mill in December 1957, she had seen little, if anything, of the Windsors. As she knew all too well, Wallace was interested in Herman and not her. After all, the only reason they invited her to stay with them was so that Wallace could soak up news of the only man she had ever loved. Lucy's note, which attempted to put aside decades of rivalry, ended with the words, "I shall always remain your friend, in memory of Hermann and the Duke." To her dismay, Lucy, who now lived in an apartment in Monte Carlo, received merely a regulation engraved card of acknowledgement. In fairness, the Duchess was somewhat overwhelmed by the outpouring of affection for the lost king. When the Duchess arrived in London for the Duke's funeral, she was gratified to learn that more than 60,000 mourners had filed past the bier inside Windsor Castle. No longer the forgotten man, he was buried in Frogmore in the castle grounds. The Duchess telling her remaining friends that she hoped that one day in the not-too-distant future she would be by his side, the first commoner allowed into the royal burial ground. That day was a very long time coming, the Duchess lingering on and on, becoming progressively more and more physically and mentally debilitated. Her home in the Bois de Boulogne became something of a living tomb, Wallace's circle shrinking to an ever-changing parade of hired nurses. In the first months after the Duke's death, she was simply forgetful. That quickly changed. Her descent into dementia was rapid, Wallace displaying alarming mood swings, one moment charming, the next aggressive and rude. During her slide, her indomitable lawyer, Maître Suzanne Blum, who had represented Charlie Chaplin, Walt Disney, and Daryl Zanuck, hovered over her, an avenging angel towards those who attempted to get too close. She crossed swords with Mountbatten, who was eager to reclaim the Duke's correspondence and historical artifacts for the royal collection at Windsor Castle. Blum complained that he was persistently on the telephone to her. "There are," she said pointedly, "nothing but vultures crowding around the garbage cans." When photographers flagrantly intruded upon the Duchess in 1976, taking pictures of nurses placing her limp form onto a sunbed, Blum, under strict French privacy laws, took legal action, winning the Duchess heavy damages. Not that the Duchess knew about the efforts on her behalf. Now, beyond looking after herself, she had withdrawn into her own world, her mind wandering further and further back in time. Her friend, the Countess de Romanones, described the gradual decline of the Duchess, the woman who had dreamed of becoming queen, now living in a dream world of her own making. She recalled, "Visiting was no longer like paying respects to a dying friend. It was like watching someone who had gradually, slowly reached a new life, where memories could keep her alive forever." Once, her memory wandered all the way back to February 1935, and she began humming a sentimental waltz that once meant so much to her and the Duke. As she danced and glided in her mind, perhaps she remembered the shadowy figures who had spun her around the dance floor, the diplomats, the businessmen, salesmen, and others who had tried to win her heart. Here comes the ardent Carter Osborne, the jovial Win Spencer, and the urbane Felipe Espiel. Then there is Jerry Green, Ernest Simpson, Guy Trundle, and of course, dear Herman, dear, dear Herman, eager to fill up the rest of her dance card, only for the Duke of Windsor to cut in. When she finally died, on April 24, 1986, aged 89, the royal family stuck to their side of the bargain and allowed her to rest next to her late husband at Frogmore. At the funeral service, held at St. George's Chapel, Windsor Castle, and attended by the royal family, the Duke would have been pleased to see that her coffin was carried by 8 soldiers from one of his former regiments, the Welsh Guards. There was, though, a bitter and immutable irony in her send-off. For in this final act of damnation, she found herself lying next to a man she barely tolerated, in the private cemetery of a family she loathed, covered by the earth of a country she hated. Even in death she would never be in peace, as her mother so often predicted. But for the decisions and revisions made in a moment, the girl from Baltimore could have been lying with Herman Rogers, the man she loved, in the quiet corner of a graveyard in the south of France that is forever America. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Wallace in Love, The Untold Life of the Duchess of Windsor, The Woman Who Changed the Monarchy, written by Andrew Morton, read by Molly Parker Myers, produced and directed by Lisa Kahn, recorded by James Zutis and Bob Lukomsky at Prose Garden Productions. Post-production by A1 Sound Studio. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of photographs. Wallace in Love is available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Andrew Morton. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.